Thank you for joining us at the Roundtable.
Brought to you by Community Education Arts, a nonprofit organization based in Noblesville, Indiana.
I'm Alice Cavanaugh Scober, President of CE Arts.
And I'm Sarah E. Morin, Secretary of CE Arts. Let's sit down at the Roundtable.
Welcome back to our first NICE workshop for 2020, when we're discussing romances and relationships in the four novels selected this year.
Welcome back, everyone, to Community Education Arts NICE workshop. This is part B, I guess, of workshop number one. NICE stands again for Noblesville Interdisciplinarity. Noblesville Interdisciplinary Creativity Expo.
Say that five times fast. Oh, I love it. We're always so careful when we pronounce that, and it's just a tongue twister. But it's nice.
It is nice. And we are talking today about four classic novels. And those are Jane Eyre, Gone with the Wind, Dracula, and Little Women. So, Alice, tell us about our pre-polls that we did for our most dysfunctional couples.
Oh, boy. Most dysfunctional relationships in these four books. Believe me, there were so many, potential brackets in our poll and everything, because there's so many dysfunctional relationships in these books. But basically, we had polls that bracketed two couples per bracket, and then the winner of that one went on to the next bracket, and we ended up with on social media, we ended up with one couple from each book was the goal for the finalists. So in our final social media polls, our couples were Jane and St. John from Jane Eyre, Scarlett and Ashley from Gone with the Wind, Jonathan and Dracula from Dracula, Joe and Amy from Little Women. Now, I have to say two things real quick. Jonathan and Dracula make a second appearance here because they were, oddly enough, they were finalists in our best relationship couple in our last session one of this workshop. So this is session two when we're talking about dysfunctional relationships. And the other thing I wanted to say was that in this list of finalists, your second place choice in our behind the scenes discussions is Jane and St. John, I think. Or maybe that was my choice. I can't remember. But anyway, my first choice in this group from our behind the scenes conversations would have been Scarlett and Rhett. And they got bumped out real early in the bracket. So our finalists were those four that I listed, and the winner was Jane and St. John from Jane Eyre. They received 100% of our Facebook votes and 66.7% of Twitter votes. And then Jonathan and Dracula got 33.3% of the Twitter votes. So I don't know what's going on with Jonathan and Dracula, but they're pretty dysfunctional. But I was sort of pleased that Jane and St. John won the social media poll overall for most dysfunctional relationship, because I think they were my number two choice. I think Jane and St. John, Jane and Rochester, Scarlett and Rhett were definitely tip-top number one for me, but I think the Jane Eyre couples, for me, there's a lot of dysfunction in both of those, and we have more to talk about in those in our behind-the-scenes podcasts and everything, but we'll probably touch on some of that today in the workshop, too. So, I don't know, those were the social media polls, so let's open up the discussion, and you and Spike chime in about what you guys think about these poll results.
Right, I'm going to give some airspace. Spike, do you want to say anything about these top four? It's okay if you don't.
And did he hear the top four? Because I know he joined us a little bit late.
The top four, again, are Jane Eyre and St. John Rivers, Scarlett and Ashley, Jonathan and Dracula, and Joe and Amy. And so you notice that not all of these are romantic relationships.
Right, that's what, yeah, we call those just dysfunctional relationships. Yeah. They don't have to be couples, yeah.
Well, Joe and Amy, I will say, I think one of the, we discussed in the first session about how Joe and Amy are very much alike in many ways, and which is probably part of the reason why Laurie ended up with Amy. But I also think that as when they were younger, that's why one of the reasons why Joe and Amy fought so much.
Yeah.
They both had fiery tempers. They were both intensely creative. You know, they were both pretty dramatic, figuratively and literally. I mean, Joe wrote plays. Amy always wanted to be the swooning ingenue in those plays and never really got the chance to be. So they are very much alike. I wouldn't say that they are dysfunctional. I mean, there are some pretty, because they're both so dramatic, there are some events that do escalate, like burning Joe's book is pretty egregious.
And when Joe is tempted to let her drown when she falls through the ice, when Amy falls through the ice, it's Laurie that really saves her, you know. And Joe is paralyzed with fear, but you also get the distinct impression in the novel, at least, that there is a moment where she's just like, okay, she fell through the ice, you know. I mean, just a split second, but and I think that's what our poll people probably were saying to bring Joe and Amy into the finalists through all the brackets and everything. I think their relationship is a little antagonistic at times.
And that brings up another good point, is that of the four girls, both Amy and Joe are the two who most actively and most consistently have to battle their darker impulses.
Yeah.
Both Joe and Amy struggle with the idea of materialism and humility, and they readily acknowledge their flaws in a lot of ways. Especially in the Castles in the Air chapter, which is beautiful and never put in any blasted adaptation, by golly. It's actually scene one in mine.
You know, I agree with you, but I also disagree with you on one point, and that is that I think Meg and Beth both have their own demons to deal with. Meg's are rarely shown in adaptations either, but she does struggle with poverty, and she has jealousy towards her peers and her friends that have money. And then when she's married to John, she does get a couple of chapters where her kind of wanting to spend money they don't really have, and kind of struggling against being the domestic goddess, if I could borrow a phrase from, I think, the 90s, where she's cooking dinner for his boss. You know, she's cooking dinner. Oh, she's making jam, and he brings home his boss for dinner unannounced. And has to deal with that.
Oh, yeah.
That's a great chapter. So she struggles with her role, I guess is the best way to put it, like in the economic class that they're in, and her role as a wife, as a female in the culture that she's in. And Beth, I think her struggles might be very subtle in the book for most people. For me, they're a little more pronounced because of the health issues that I have in my own childhood growing up with those, and fears of dying, and her struggles of coming to terms with her place in the world being very small, a small place in a small world. You know, her world is small. She comes to terms with the fact that she's not ever going to have the big dreams, the big goals, the big life, that life itself is not going to happen for her. And so I feel like the one thing I would just, you know, kind of add to what you said, I totally agree with what you said about Joe and Amy, but I do think that Meg and Beth both have their own darker challenges to work with and deal with, and I think both do it. I think all four girls are successful. Joe does eventually tame her temper a little bit. Amy becomes much more mature than we ever would have expected from the first chapters of the novel.
Yeah.
Beth comes to terms with her dying and her own death as she dies, and Meg becomes, you know, a wonderful wife and mother who is happy in her domestic situation and her economic situation and proud of her husband and everything. So I do feel like they all have their challenges. I think that we have more fun with Joe and Amy's challenges because they're usually about temper or creativity or, you know, sister jealousy or something. They're more fun as a reader to experience. Whereas Meg's and Beth's aren't quite as much fun, you know. Yeah. So,
You said something interesting about Beth, that she is kind of, pardon my Tourette's there. She kind of makes peace with her, what I would call a life lived small.
Yes.
But at the same time, even through the other two books, and in the second half of Little Women, she has, on the other three girls, has the largest emotional and spiritual impact.
Yeah, that's true.
Because while she does struggle with that small life that she lives, she is also, as sort of a trade-off, the one that I believe in the end is closest to God.
Yes, she is. She is. She has the... And our passage that we picked this year is actually her explaining to Joe how she feels about all that. And it's a beautifully written passage. And it's... It touches on that exact point. Yeah. And I think she does stay with them, all the girls, as they go through the rest of their lives and into both the sequels that Louisa May Alcott wrote. You know, so I agree with you. She has the longest life in a way, the most impactful life in a way, I guess. But, you know, but we do see her character struggle with giving up, you know, longevity and health. And that's that's poignant. It's very touching in the in the book. So what did you think, Spike, what did you think about the other some of the other relationships in this category that made it to the finals, you know?
I didn't find St. John to be all that bad. I think he was an okay person. He was insistent. He just simply wasn't a good match.
Yeah.
and that I would like to say a little bit about Jane and Rochester, though, if that's okay. Because I know that feels like a very dysfunctional relationship in many ways.
Yeah, I think we can definitely in our workshop talk about other relationships that didn't make it to the finals, you know.
I think that Rochester, you know, Sarah and I discussed this at length. I think that Jane very much is the one who reforms and even redeems or saves Rochester in a very spiritual and overtly Christian sense. She is the instrument of his salvation in a way that kind of frees and releases him from his past sins. And only after he has become redeemed and kind of purified himself, is he then a suitable partner for Jane? Mm-hmm. And then she says, well, of course I married him, which I love. But so, you know, I do see that relationship as fraught with danger in the beginning, even though there's a deep spiritual connection. He talks about the thread between his chest and hers.
That's our passage, that we picked,
Yeah, that deep spiritual connection, but also that is a relationship that I think if it had blossomed or if they'd married earlier, could have potentially become even abusive.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Sarah E., do you want to weigh in before we get back to St. John and Jane Eyre or whoever? I mean, we don't have to get back to them.
Sure, no, I would absolutely agree, and... Yeah, I did not, as much as I love Jane and Rochester, I did not vote on them as being a functional couple because they aren't functional until really the end of the book.
Right.
It takes them that long to grow as individuals and in how they relate to each other in some ways.
Yeah.
But by the end, I think they're a great couple. As I look at the arc of the whole book, just like Joe and Amy, if we're to judge them when they're, what, like 12, 13, and 15... yeah, they don't get along then, just like a lot of siblings. Mm-hmm. But if we look at them, you know, when they're in their late teens, early 20s, yeah, they've grown a lot by then. So yeah. It's just, you know, the growth that takes place.
Well, yeah, that brings up an interesting thing about a lot of the characters that we're talking about. In some of these relationships that are male and female, there's a very huge age gap, which we'll be talking about in other arenas, other parts. We don't really have to get into that today, but I think Jane Eyre, isn't she like 18 or 19 when she meets Rochester, and he's in his 30s, so... and St. John is also much older than she is. I think we'll be talking more about different relationships, but I remember from our notes that your first place in this category, Sarah E., was basically Dracula and almost anybody. It was like Dracula and Jonathan, Dracula and Mina, Dracula and Lucy, pretty much anyone he wants to feed on, which, you know, you called him definitely the abusive seducer, and I just love that because I feel like Dracula is, the book and the character are kind of in their own category when it comes to these categories that we have in this workshop, because he is just, you know, he's out for blood, literally, you know. Yep. He has no qualms about who anybody will do, you know. So he does have his, he does want Jonathan, Mina, and Lucy, you know, the most, but he definitely will just feed on anybody. My top picks, again, were in this category, were Scarlet and Rhett, and Jane and St. John. I really found St. John to be very, very abusive, and I know that we and Spike and you and I see him as a very different character, a very different man, I guess I should say. And I was so creeped out by him in the whole book.
So why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about why you find him so objectionable?
Okay, in brief, because we will have longer behind-the-scenes podcast sessions on abuse and domestic abuse and stuff like that, but I found him to be almost the epitome of the psychological, emotional abuser. He is kind of classic with that. And I have to be fair and say Rochester has a lot of those elements too. But when we talk about abuse, the process of Jane's victimization by Rochester and St. John is similar. They both lead her down the garden path, so to speak. She's very easily manipulated by them, and they both want to control her life and her decisions. And you know, it's got to be said, they also want her physically. That, you know, they want to marry her, and in the context of the time period that the book was written in, that means they want to have sex with her. I mean, they're not going to have a marriage without sex, right? Now Rochester's a little bit different than St. John because his motives throughout the book are, you know, in the name of love. We are to believe that his motives when he manipulates Jane, when he kind of, you know, guides the course of her life with him and everything, is in the name of love. He loves her. I think that's probably a lot to do with Bronte's own lack of worldly experience and the time period in which she wrote, but that's fine. He's kind of a bad boy. St. John is quite different to me. His efforts to control and possess Jane are much, much creepier to me. His process of control and manipulation is something that, like I said, it really aligns well with the patterns of abuse that exist even through today's understanding of how domestic violence and abuse can happen. So, like I said, we'll go into more detail on my thoughts on that and other people's, you know, thoughts on that in other episodes. But I do feel like they have a very one-sided relationship in terms of control. St. John is much more in control than Jane is. But you know, what do you think about that?
I thank you first for giving that perspective, because that wasn't a perspective that I had ever in reading the book. I do agree, though, that they don't make a good romantic couple.
Right.
In part, he is pretty bossy toward the end of it, like, you gotta marry me.
Yeah.
But even that regardless, Because he does do some things that are nice for her. He makes sure that, you know, she's stranded on the moors, that she, you know, has a place to live, she has a job. So in my perspective, he's not as bad as a human being, but he's bad for her because it's all about the, we have a life goal, or at least my life goal is being a missionary, that ought to be your life goal too. So they'd be better as a business partnership, but he rejects the idea of just having a business partnership.
Right, and that's exactly.
Views of love are just very, very different, and they're very, very incompatible.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think you and I see some of his good deeds, as you refer to them, differently. I see him setting up Jane in the school as a teacher as a way of keeping her close to him. Yes, it provides her with a living, and she's able to work there and everything, but it's under his supervision. I mean, she's literally under his supervision. I mean, if this story were written in modern day time period, this would be sexual harassment, you know. I mean, he's her boss, you know, and he does want her to be his wife when he goes off to be a missionary in another country. He does not, she very politely says, I'll be more than happy to go with you as your sister, as a companion, as a helpmate. And he says, no, you go as my wife or nothing. And to me, that speaks to the element of marriage and sex that he is determined to get her to agree to. She very politely says no to him several times, and he just does not take no for an answer until, you know, at the very end of the book, we realize that he had to take no for an answer because she, you know, got some wealth and married and then and went back to find Rochester and lived happily ever after. And so, of course, he had to, you know, not marry her because she married someone else. But, spoiler alerts, right? But, I mean, his whole relationship with Jane is based on his desire for her and to control her. And that is creepy to me. I find him much creepier than you did. But hey, that's what makes the world go round, is different opinions, right?
Sure.
Join us next time as we continue our workshop discussions of the romances and relationships in our 4 nice books this year. This has been At the Round Table with Alice
and Sarah E.
of Community Education Arts.
Our nonprofit organization is based in Noblesville, Indiana. You can find us online at cearts.org. We'd like to thank James Weston for writing our intro music and for his technical savvy.
Join us next time
at the Roundtable.